Good afternoon. We're very honored to have as our guest today Michael Barone. As we all know, Michael is one of the most respected political analysts in the country. He's written for many publications, including The Economist, The New York Times, The Weekly Standard, The American Spectator, The London Telegraph. He is now the senior political analyst for The Washington Examiner. He is a resident fellow at AEI, and he's a regular contributor to Fox News. Interestingly, Michael coined the phrase gangster government to describe the Obama administration's approach to the Chrysler bailout, where the secured creditors got much less than they would have in a normal bankruptcy, and surprise, surprise, the UAW got much more. Gangster government has turned out to be an unusually useful phrase to describe many other of the administration's initiatives. Notably, Michael is the principal author of the Almanac of American Politics, published every 2 years. The Almanac collects an ocean of statistics and has brief summaries of the political situation in each state and indeed in each congressional district. The Almanac has been described by George Will as the Bible of American politics. Reflecting that same religious theme, Karl Rove observed during the 2010 election cycle, quote, "Barone's got me. He is a god. We worship him in certain circles." Michael.
Well, you can't beat an introduction like that. I'd ask you all to bow your heads. And, 2 years ago, I appeared before the Federalist Society before the election, and I began my comments by saying, you can't win them all. This year, I guess the motto is, you can win some of them. We've really just been through two historic elections, in effect, when you look at some of the numbers. You had a record number of votes for the Democratic Party in 2008 and a record number for Republicans in 2010. And I don't think it's widely realized, but go back to 2008. You look at Barack Obama was elected with 53% of the popular vote. That's more than any other Democratic nominee in history except for Andrew Jackson, Franklin Roosevelt, and Lyndon Johnson. It's more than Harry Truman, more than John Kennedy, more than Woodrow Wilson. It's more even than Bill Clinton, much to his dismay. The popular vote for the House 2008 was 54-43 Democratic. That may not sound like a huge number, but in fact it is, it's the best Democrats had done since 1986 when they were winning most of the popular votes in the South, which of course they aren't anymore. And it's the best Democrats did in the 36 non-Southern states since 1900, probably since ever. It was actually a record performance for the Democrats in the majority of the country that has not already fled high taxes for the South. That was a great victory for the Democrats. 2010, a big swing, 9% swing in the popular vote for the House. That's very unusual. We haven't seen a popular vote swing like that since the late 1940s, more than 60 years ago. It was the Republicans ended up with a popular vote majority of 52-45. We haven't quite, California takes 5 weeks to tabulate its votes. They had an election in Brazil on October 31st. They had them tabulated within 5 hours. There is something wrong with this picture. But nonetheless, actually, they hired the guy from King County, Washington, that handled the 2004 governor election, the guy with the magic cupboard that had as many Democratic votes as you need. He's now the Los Angeles County vote counter. So you look at the potentials there. The Republicans actually... The 52-45 is better for Republicans than they got at any time since 1946. And in fact, if you go back to 1946, you'll find that only 10% of the popular vote was cast in the South, which was then the most Democratic region in the country. If the South had voted proportionate to population in 1946, as it pretty much does today, the Republican percentage in 1946 would have been lower than today. So we're looking at something that hasn't been equaled at least since the 1920s, and even Speaker Nancy Pelosi hasn't been around since the 1920s. She's old enough to remember the 1946 and 48 elections when her father was a member of Congress, but not the 1928 election. Looking back over the years that I've written this book, Almanac of American Politics, or been co-author, it's been 40 years now since I started working on it. It's actually kind of unusual for a book like that to have been written by somebody who was 4 years old the first time. Looking back on that, I think we have two kinds of periods in our politics, periods of open field politics and periods of trench warfare politics. And trench warfare politics is when you have pretty steady voting behavior. Issue focus remains pretty much the same from election to election, and the results go along pretty much the same way. And we had periods of trench warfare politics in the 1980s up to 1991, and political scientists came out with theories about why we would, Republicans had a lock on the presidency. There were structural reasons for that, and that the Democrats had eternal control of Congress, and there were structural reasons for that, and it would always be true. And indeed, when you look at the election results from 1982 to 1990, it sort of looks that way. Then we had a period of open field politics, 1991 to 1995, and all the old rules were broken. Bill Clinton was elected president in 1992. The Republican lock on the presidency was broken. In 1994, Newt Gingrich and the Republicans won a majority in both houses. Newt predicted that majority, and actually predicted the majority in 1986, 1988, 1990, 1992. He had the right reasons, in fact. It just didn't happen until 1994, but it did, in fact, happen. And we had two third-party candidacies in a country where supposedly the major parties, there's no real alternative there, too. We had Colin Powell leading in the polls against putative major party candidates in the fall of 1995, and Ross Perot leading in the polls in spring 1992. You remember Ross Perot then left that race, and he said the first President Bush was going to send the Air Force in to strafe his daughter's wedding. Came back in the race. 19% of our fellow citizens voted for this man, although he was obviously clinically insane. That period went on for several years. Then we had a period of trench warfare politics, 1995 to 2005, in which the two parties, both politicians and voters, were like two equal-sized armies in a culture war, fighting it out for small bits of terrain that made the difference between victory and defeat. The demographic factor most highly correlated with voting behavior was religion or degree of religiosity. This was the, I remember being at Fox News on election day 2000, 10 years ago in New York, and we got the first tranche of exit polls in the key states, and one after another they showed very close races within the margin of error. And I had a two-word comment looking forward to election night, of which I'll relay only the first word to you, which was, oh. So Britt Hume said to me, well, Michael, this election may not be decided till the wee hours of the morning. And I said, Britt, this election may not be decided for 2 or 3 days. Well, it took 36 days and a 7-2 decision by the Supreme Court to finally settle that election. That was what I called the 49% nation in the Almanac of American Politics. You had that very narrow band of support. You look for the popular vote for the House, the Repubs were about 49-51, the Democrats about 46-48. Throughout that period, the Republicans won more popular votes, more seats, but never by a wide margin. And Bush was reelected in 2004 by a 51-48 margin, over John Francois Kerry, who many of you will remember. mais oui, au contraire, le windsurf. Anyway, 2005, that changed. We went from a period of trench warfare politics to a period of open field politics. We went Hurricane Katrina, the continued violence and increasing violence in Iraq, and Democrats The issue focus changed sharply. We had, $4 gasoline suddenly changed people's attitudes on whether you should drill for oil in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska. Prior to that, at $3.50, most people said we must preserve the pristine environment. And at $4 gas, they said, nuke the caribou. Drill, baby, drill. Anyway, as you know, in 2006 and 2008, Democrats had winning performances. Indeed, in 2008, as I've argued, something of an historical record. In response, we had the political philosopher James Carville predicting 40 years of Democratic dominance. It turned out to be more like 40 weeks. Republicans passed Democrats in the generic ballot question, which party's candidate do you want to vote for House of Representatives, in August 2009, which about 40 weeks after the election. My view, the Obama Democrats made a fundamental miscalculation. They interpreted the Republicans' defeats not just as a negative verdict on competence, but as a rejection of ideology. And they assumed that economic distress would make Americans more supportive of, or at least amenable to, big government policies. I mean, this was the lesson taught by the New Deal historians based on the 1930s and 40s. I have argued that that lesson was wrong, or at least incomplete, that you needed a more nuanced version of history. I provided one in my book, Our Country, The Shaping of America, From Roosevelt to Reagan, available on Amazon.com for $3.50. And I would have recommended it to President Obama, but I don't think that he's one of my purchasers there. But it's uncanny. If you go back to polling in the late 1930s, the New Deal, unemployment was, hovering well over 10%. Voters wanted less government spending. They thought uncertainty about tax and regulatory policy was stopping economic growth and preventing investment creation of new jobs. They thought labor unions were getting too powerful. Sounds kind of familiar, actually. You look at the other Anglosphere democracies in the 1930s, they rejected big government parties in the United Kingdom and Australia and in Canada. So I think that the Obama people were basing their assumptions on erroneous history, and certainly the verdict of the last couple of this election is very clear. It's a rejection of the vast expansion of the size and scope of government by the Obama Democrats. I mean, they banned the use of the word stimulus in the campaign. I guess you can use it if your appearances by former President Clinton, but the auto bailout, Michigan voted for 58-40 for a Republican governor. The health care bill jammed through after voters pleaded with the Democrats not to pass it through the medium of national public opinion polls and through the unlikely medium of the voters of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. The Democrats passed the most unpopular major piece of legislation that I can think of since the Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854. That resulted in the destruction of one political party and the relegation of minority status for decades of the other. I'm not sure that this is going to have that much of an effect, but it's obviously a big rejection of the big government policies. And I think the most fascinating development of the last couple of years, and it's fascinating to me because I didn't predict it, if something happens that I predict, it's not like I'm learning something, I already knew it, but if something happens that I didn't predict, then I have an opportunity to learn, is the emergence of what is called the Tea Party movement, the inrush into political activity of hundreds of thousands or even millions of people around this country, motivated by concern over bailouts of people that behaved imprudently, motivated by concerns about the doubling of the national debt as a percentage of gross domestic product, the increase in federal spending from 21% to 25% of GDP, and motivated as well by the words and deeds of the founding fathers. I think this is a reflection of a wider trend in society. Over the last 15 years, we've had books by the founding fathers that have been bestsellers. If you went to the beach one summer, you saw everybody reading a biography of John Adams. I mean, who would have thunk that? But the fact is, we're going back to the theory of the founding fathers. And I think you can see the politics of the last couple of years as a test case between the theories of the progressives and the New Dealers on the one hand, 100 years old, 70 years old, and the theories of the founding fathers on the other, 220, 230 years old. And the progressives and the New Dealers said that the Constitution and the founders, you know, horse and buggy theories. They were out of date. In a modern industrial era with big factories and technological marvels like the Model T, you just couldn't have limits on government. You needed to have centralized experts, command and control government systems to guide ordinary people who really aren't very smart anyway. We didn't know them at school, in order to make their way through life. It's encouraged a culture of dependence. And I think what a majority of voters were saying in this year was that that stuff sounds kind of tinny and old-fashioned. It's like, you know, pre-dial phones and Model Ts. That's not the most up-to-date thing. And that the words and actions and theories and ideas of the Founding Fathers still ring as true as a silver spoon on a crystal goblet. So I'm not going to go over all the results. We still have a few House races that are left unresolved. They've counted the absentee ballots in Alaska, and they've, you know, sort of a spelling lesson up there. How many could spell Murkowski? It appears that the pork Republican there beat the kosher Republican. One way to describe them. You know, after the 2008, some liberal commentators were saying the Republican Party is restricted to a few places in the Deep South, the Great Plains. They're, you know, battening down in their strongholds. Now you can say that the Democratic Party is restricted to a few strongholds. Basically, the 2010 tsunami was pretty much prevalent between the George Washington Bridge and the Donner Pass. It left the cannibals standing at both ends. So, you know, Democratic strongholds are now where you have super strong public employee unions. They've got the state governments in California, Illinois, and Florida, who may be coming, or Florida, New York, rather. It's all the New Yorkers who went to Florida, but they, in some of the states in New England, I think some of these state governments may be coming to Washington because the bond market vigilantes aren't going to lend them any more money. It will be interesting to see what their reaction is from the Republican House of Representatives. Maybe some delicious moments there. If you look at congressional districts where Democrats are still strong, black voters, they're still very strong with them. Hispanic voters, though, it's a mixed bag around the country. Hispanic voters in Florida voted Republican. Hispanic voters in Texas gave Republicans large minorities of the vote. The real strength of the Democratic Party and the heart and soul is, I think my friend Joel Kotkin calls, gentry liberals. And since you people are affluent people living in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area, you know just who I mean. They've even, you know, threatening to take over McLean in Great Falls, Virginia. The affluent liberals who were concerned about issues of voting on issues of cultural issues, foreign policy issues, Nancy Pelosi's district in San Francisco is a clear example. Let me just conclude with a couple words about 2012. And I think that it's risky in a period of open field politics to make straight line extrapolations from any single set of election results, including those of 2010, however tempted one may be to do so. Barack Obama in 2000 does not have a horrible job performance rating right now. It's negative, but only slightly so. He's probably not going to have primary opposition, except perhaps from a left-wing candidate of the peace movement wing of the Democratic Party. I think most Democrats will be reluctant to challenge him in the first black American president in primary contests, which average 20% black electorates. Balance of enthusiasm, which favored Republicans, obviously, in this cycle, may not favor them as much again. We'll see a more robust turnout of black voters, most likely. All those singles apartment developments in Washington and Arlington, Alexandria, they're all infested with Obama voters. They may come back out and vote. I think there's going to be a reluctance on the part of many Americans to reject the first black president. I think that's an understandable feeling in light of our history. And there's a presumption sometimes in favor of incumbents. It helped Bill Clinton in 96, helped George W. Bush in 2004. Nonetheless, I think that we do have a pretty clear verdict on here, and it's not just a negative verdict on the bad economy, which has, of course, caused people to relinquish science and reason and just bitterly cling to God and guns, noted political observer's theory. I think it represents, Americans have not been presented with the realistic possibility of a vast expansion of the size and scope of government of this sort in a very long time. I would argue, think you make the argument that they haven't been faced with this since the end of World War II, when we saw voters in the UK go for the Labour government, national health insurance, nationalizing industries. President Roosevelt, in one of his last State of the Union addresses, called for national health care, public housing, getting rid of the private market and housing, federal aid to education, big takeover of health care, and so forth. The Congress is elected in those big swing elections in the late 1940s, basically rejected that program and limited the scope of labor unions. That was a decision that made possible the prosperity of post-war America. And I think Americans seem to be reacting once again, as they did then, with a robust rejection of a vast expansion of the size and scope of government. Thanks very much.
Okay. We do have time for a couple questions. If you have a question, please make sure it's to the point, and we'll call the question in a couple minutes. But, sir.
Yeah. Could you talk a little bit about what's happened in state legislatures around the country? We had a panel that talked about constitutional reform. Is there a possibility that there might be a conservative enough group of state legislators to propose conservative constitutional reform?
Well, I think the answer is yes. There may be enough wacky people to do that. I mean, it's interesting. The Republicans gained 6 Senate seats, a little fewer than they thought they might do. They gained 60-plus House seats, which is about what I was predicting and what some of the other predictors came to, which is a little more than 94. In 94, with the same percentage of popular vote for the House, they gained about 450 state legislature seats. This year, they gained about 680. And in state after state that I've looked at, where I followed the local prognosticators, the political insiders like Michigan, Minnesota, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Republicans overachieved what almost all the insiders were predicting. They picked up state legislative seats that nobody thought they were going to get. And sometimes when you do that, you don't know what the heck the people that won those seats are going to believe. So I think the answer is that it's a wide open field out there in state legislatures. Republicans have emerged in a good position for redistricting, as you know, many of you political buffs know. But I think they've got an opportunity in state governments to throw a lot of sand in the gears of Obamacare, which is not a self-propelling vehicle but needs fuel and fiddling with and so forth. Constitutional things, I wouldn't rule it out.
I think, like most of the people in this room, I have a party affiliation. It may have changed over the years.
Mine too.
But I wonder, who are the independent voters? Why can't they make up their mind? Why do they seem so changeable?
Well, the independent voters, were about 57-37 for Democratic House candidates in 2008, and then switched toward Republicans. I think one reason, people don't make up their mind is sometimes they vote on events and on competence. I mean, I think the rejection of the Repubs in 2006 and 2008 was a rejection of competence, not ideology. A lot of people, including a lot of Democrats, would disagree with me, and you can argue about it, but I think the election results fortify that pretty well. And I think that the vast expansion of the size and scope of government that the Obama Democrats presented the American voters with as a realistic possibility, as something that could really happen, was, I think, a case of first impression for most voters. We hadn't really faced that. I mean, you could ask voters sometimes, would you like to have the government pay all your health care bills? Well, yeah, that sounds kind of nice, You ask young voters that, they say, yeah, it's like university health service. You get free counseling and condoms. That's great. We've now got, they're touting the provision of the health care bill that lets 26-year-olds go on mommy and daddy's health insurance. They don't say that in order to hold down costs, there have to be certain limits the government will insist on, and late night behavior can be hazardous, auto accidents, unwanted pregnancies. They have to be home by 10:30 on weeknights. and 10 and midnight on weekends if you want to be on mommy and daddy's health insurance. So, you know, but yeah, I think, you know, people respond to events and they respond to cases of first impression, and they don't always respond in the same way.
I live in New Jersey. I have a question about Governor Christie.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. You know, Governor Christie won the straw poll among the Tea Partiers a couple of months ago, but I think what a lot of people forget is
it was a weighted average.
Yeah, he was. He came out of a Republican primary when he ran for governor where he was not the Conservative Party candidate. He was not the Tea Party candidate. And what do you make of the fact that Christie is so popular right now, and he's being portrayed in the media as, I think, being much more conservative than he is?
Well, I think the part of it is change in issue focus. I mean, it's trench warfare politics of 95-05, the issue focus was a lot, particularly within the parties, on a lot of these cultural issues. So you had Mitt Romney in 2007 going around the 99 counties of Iowa saying about how he'd always been against abortion, which inconveniently wasn't entirely true, but, you know, he was doing that because that was the litmus test you had to pass to win a Republican presidential nomination in the trench warfare politics period. The issue focus stayed steady. What we see now is we see a series of issue focuses which suggest, among other things, that Romney would have been wise in 2008 to campaign on the financial system and his business expertise. Skip Iowa and the caucus goers median age 72. And go to New Hampshire, and so forth. That's the advantage of hindsight. But when the issue changes to the size and scope of government, then Chris Christie, who is not thought of in 95-05 terms as one of the far-right conservatives, but nonetheless facing those budget decisions and taking tough decisions against the teachers' unions, taking umbrage when they envisaged with glee the idea that he would die, he took them on, and he's taken them on, obviously, in these public forums. The medium of YouTube enables us to see him in all his full glory. And, different issues will put people at different places in the perceived ideological spectrum.
Last question.
You mentioned the correlation in 1995 to 2005 of religiosity being a key element of voting behavior. Do you see any resurgence or return to that type of correlation in the 2010 results?
Well, there's still a high correlation of that. I mean, if you look at the class of Republican voters, you find that they're culturally conservative. They tend to be, not all of them are. And Democratic voters tend to be culturally liberal. I think those issues are just of a lot less salience to voters now, and I don't see them being revived lately because this vast expansion in size and scope of government is an ongoing issue. Obamacare, unlike Hillary Care, is still alive. Nobody has yet put a stake through its heart. And so that's going to remain an issue. We've got a 10% deficit in budget, federal budget deficit, 10% of GDP. So that's a raging issue. You listen to the political philosopher Glenn Beck, which I'm sure you all do. They asked him about same-sex marriage, and he said, "I don't want to talk about it. There are more important things to talk about than that." And I think that's emblematic of a lot of feelings. Mitch Daniels, the governor of Indiana, who won 58-40 in a state that Barack Obama was carrying, 2008, ran 1 point ahead of Ronald Reagan in the state's most affluent county, carried 20% of blacks, 37% of Hispanics, and young voters, 51-42. Mitch Daniels said we should have a truce in the culture war, and a lot of people objected to that. I think we have a truce in the culture war right now. People are not yelling at each other about these issues anymore because we're faced with a different set of issues that most voters on whichever side of the issue think are more salient and more pressing and the subject that they want to cast their votes on.